Today on Rockin' the Suburbs.
I think people had a real personal connection to Martin, to the music.
Rest in power, Martin. Hey everybody, Patrick Foster here. I want to welcome you to Rockin' the Suburbs. Last week, while we were airing our Suburbs Fest episodes, unfortunately, some very sad news from the world of music and sad news from the world of Flying Nun, which, as regular listeners know, is dear to our hearts here at Suburbs Pod. And with me today is Nick Scalera. Nick, it's wonderful to talk to you. I haven't heard from you in a little bit here, but I'm sorry that it has to be on a topic like this, the passing of Martin Phillips from The Chills.
Yeah, glad to be here and speak with you, but not on this topic necessarily.
It was
a real shock. And I think, as we've talked about on the pod many times before, we feel a closeness to some of these artists that just doesn't really match up to anything else in the real world. And when something like this happens unexpectedly out of the blue, it's taking me, I think it's about, has it been about a week or 4 or 5 days. I'm having a hard time processing it right now, but I'm glad to have the chance to talk about it with someone who also probably is as, affected as I am. Martin is, he's the kind of artist that some folks hold near and dear and many just have never heard of. Right. So that's where we are.
And you texted me when the news broke early in the morning, and I was glad I was in bed actually, because I just didn't feel like getting out of bed. I just laid there for, a couple hours just thinking, God, this is the worst. And listeners can go back and find an interview that we conducted with Martin backstage at the Black Cat several years ago. And I think, we both said that was a highlight of not only the podcast, but, both of our musical
for sure.
lives, to be able to meet him. And he was so nice, so gracious. And just really was, it's one of those things that makes you feel even worse about, losing him. And you just feel, like you said, just totally gutted. But talk a little bit, Nick, about Martin's career trajectory. The Chills have always seemed to be tinged with this sort of sadness and, tragedy that sort of followed them, including an early drummer, Martin Bull, who passed away from leukemia at a very young age. He was one of the key lineups of the Chills, and Martin even changed the name of the band at one point. He was so affected, he was going to call it A Wrinkle in Time instead, but went back to the Chills, thankfully. And there's always been something, tragic around this band and around Martin for whatever
reason.
Yeah,
I mean, you can always go back to the Flying Nun episodes if you want. I won't go through the whole history.
Yes.
but it's suffices to say that the Chills were really at the center of the Dunedin sound and of Flying Nun Records. And very early on, in the early 80s, they were identified as Martin Phillips specifically was identified as the songwriter who maybe had a chance to break out of New Zealand into a larger market because he could write just amazing pop tunes. And his sensibility was informed by all of the greats, Love, the Beatles, Brian Wilson especially. And you hear the pop sensibility and the way he could craft a pop song, and specifically often crafting songs with melancholy lyrics, but really upbeat, jingle jangly, shimmering music.
how cruel it is of me wishing you near to me. Now that you're finally free, my friend, you know I see. But what did I want to know? Did you scream or fall? I know it sounds so cold, but it's not at all.
So there was a lot of hope and promise around Martin and the Chills early on. But of course, if you know anything about the Chills, you know that he went through band members, especially in the early days, at a very fast rate. And it was hard yep. for them to get any sort of consistency. Drummers, bassists, keyboard players came in and out. There was, in the early days, a lot of singles, a lot of EPs, a lot of material to kind of sift through. But, you know, there was a sense that they would eventually break through if things could just kind of fall right for Martin and the Chills. And in the mid-80s, I believe, or maybe mid to late 80s, they went to England, which was a big deal for a Flying Nun artist to fly the coop and kind of put up with the hometown anger over that and try to make it big. And, you know, they kind of, to make a long story short, they came close a couple of times, and by 1990, they put out their arguably their most complete album, Submarine Bells, which has Heavenly Pop Hit, which was probably their most successful song. It certainly sold the most in New Zealand. And it got airplay in the U.S., and folks heard it. And there was a sense of optimism around 1990. But very soon after, that lineup of the Chills fell apart. Then they went to L.A. and recorded a follow-up that is a great album for Chills fans, but not really an accessible album for the rest of the world. And things just kind of fell apart in the mid-90s. And also the music world had moved on. I mean, we were into grunge at that time and harder stuff. And Martin is still doing this Gretsch guitar, you know, rich open chords kind of stuff. wasn't really in vogue. And then, you know, Martin, you know, kind of when his career sort of collapsed in the mid-90s, you know, then he fell into drug addiction and didn't, you know, caught hepatitis C. And he wasn't really producing music for 10 to 12 years, I believe. But what's so sad about this is that, and really just crushing, is that by around 2014 or 15, he got some new treatments for his Hep C that really that seemed to be working and gave him essentially a new lease on, a lease on life. It's like he had cheated death, because at one point he was his liver function was like minimal at best, and he didn't know how long he had to live. And the good news is that, you know, he really took advantage of his kind of second life, putting out some great albums. He had a stable lineup. He was touring the world. That's when Patrick and I and the Bish got to talk to him in 2019 at the Black Hat. And it was just a celebration of Martin and the Chills and the music and how much it meant to so many of us. And I mean, Martin was so kind and gracious, and he smiled. That's what surprised me. You don't really think, you know, a guy from New Zealand, he smiled, he laughed.
I know.
it was just a smile plastered on his face throughout the whole set at the Black Hat, at the appreciation. So, you know, just absolutely lovely that he was able to kind of make this career come back, fly around the world, see his adoring fans, and then all of a sudden, it was gone, like in a night, and there was very little awareness that things had turned south with his condition, but apparently he had been in the hospital a few days. But I think, aside from the whole musical thing, it's just like, it's, you know, you can't cheat death. It gets you eventually, and, you know, Martin had a second chance, and this is just like, God, you know, what the hell? Like, you can't, I don't know. I've spoken too much, but and there's a lot of rock star deaths out there, but this one was just really kind of crushing, because I think we all assumed that Martin was going to go on and for a long time and tour, and like there's going to be new music and everything was good. But then in like a couple of days, it wasn't.
I mean, that's what got me the sense of, like, this isn't fair. He rode through the Valley of Death already and came out on the other side. He's one of the rare people that did it, and he got that chance. Now he gets his chance to go on into his 70s and be an elder statesman of music and all that. And there's something I wanted to read to you, Nick. I was looking through Roger Shepherd's book, who founded Flying Nun Records. And obviously, you know, Martin, as you said, was instrumental in the whole record label. I mean, he was right there at the very beginning. He played keyboards on the Clean's Tally Ho. He was with the group at the very beginning. It was just, you know, a scene. He was in a band called The Same that played with Toy Love, one of the earliest, most influential New Zealand bands. But something that Roger writes in his paragraph, I'd love to get your thoughts on this. And you touched on it briefly, I think, but more directly, Roger wrote, quote, "The Chills wrote and played songs that needed a great deal of attention in the studio, and the consequent expense meant they had no real choice other than to have a crack at commercial mainstream success. They were an intelligent pop band. Martin knew he needed a variety of material to demonstrate that they were, and he very effectively delivered it." So it was like you're saying, he was able to do, and Submarine Bells and Soft Bomber, a great contrast in that he could do everything, you know, and it seemed like his mind was always creating songs. There are these legends of how many fragments of songs, right, that he's recorded and has on tape anywhere. But would you agree with that statement? They were just a band that needed something different from all the other, you know, bands on Flying Nun because of the way Martin wrote songs and produced them and all that.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, as we talked about at some great length, I mean, the sort of the keystone of the Flying Nun movement was DIY four track recording. And Martin's sound was just too ambitious to be captured that way. Now, granted, some of the early four track stuff sounds great. I mean, Pink Frost sounds great. The ambitions were higher. And I think his sort of genius was the ability to pull in, like, all these 60s influences and whatever was sort of in the water in Dunedin and just create this new synthesis. But it often, you know, it went beyond the technical capabilities, and it also went beyond often the capabilities of his bandmates. And that's why in the early days, Martin was known as being kind of tough to work with. And this was why there was a lot of band members in and out. And one of the things that comes up in the documentary that came out a few years ago called The Triumph and the Tragedy of Martin Phillips, aptly named,
right,
was that he felt bad about the way he had treated some of his bandmates, and he gave them a chance to kind of air the laundry. And he's mm-hmm. essentially, and that's another thing that's so crushing. He really hit a tone with a lot of the early band members and with his new band, and why some of the later albums are really so great and they sound so lushly produced is that Martin wasn't acting as a one-man band. You know, back in some lineups, right, Martin would bring in the demo and it's like, what else is there to put in here? But with his current lineup, there's a lot more contributions and a lot more appreciation. And that's why the current lineup had been together for about 20 years. You know, so you had like 13 lineups in 10 years and then one lineup in 20. I think that was always that Martin, there was a sense early on that he was too big for the Flying Nun scene, even though no one wanted to admit it. It was probably hard for Roger Shepherd to admit that, both from a technical standpoint and also just from an audience standpoint. It was a sense that there was a desire for Martin's music to be heard worldwide. And to do this, you had to kind of branch out to a certain extent. But it didn't work. And with him, none of the other Flying Nun bands ever, you know, the other bands tried to follow that route to England and Australia and whatnot to the breakout. But Martin was the one. And it was just tough when it all kind of fell apart the way it did.
It really was. And, you know, your point is so well made there about the fact that he was difficult to work with. He was a perfectionist and he wanted it to sound a certain way all the time that he heard in his mind, which, you know, constantly was there for him. But he did feel bad about it. He wasn't a mean person. It was just his music that he cared about so much. And famously, one of the people who was going to be leaving the Chills, he wrote a song with them to actually document his leaving the band.
Yeah.
Good night, Alan. Good night, Martin.
Good night, Peter.
Good night, Martin.
Good night, Martin.
Good night, world.
Good night, Chills.
Do you think when he made Submarine Bells that he was finally satisfied that he was able to go in the studio, get every little piece just the way he wanted it, get it produced right, have enough money to do that, and then have that come out? I mean, it always seemed like there was something always that wasn't satisfying, you know, to him or to somebody, right? Brave Words had all the songs, but the production was so bad, you know, and all those things. Do you think Submarine Bells was really the one where he got it right, or do you think he ever really did?
I don't think he ever really did, and I guess the reason why I would say that, and this is not to cast aspersions on Submarine Bells, which is a near-perfect album to any listener, but if you kind of look at what he did with the next album, it makes me think that he wasn't quite satisfied. And, you know, if you make the argument that Submarine Bells was like, all right, this is the radio-friendly music, clearly, Martin was never going to be pleased just doing that kind of stuff. I mean, when you get to the next album, there's like one song that has three different versions. There's like snippets of things. And it's kind of like, it's very much like the Smile next to Pet Sounds. You know, it's sort of like Submarine Bells is the Pet Sounds because you can at least listen to it. But Smile is like a sprawling project. And Martin was a huge admirer of Brian Wilson. But yeah, I can't imagine. I mean, I think later in life, in the last few albums, you know, probably just through the process of aging and understanding and sort of having a perspective, that I think he seemed in interviews very pleased with the last couple of albums that he recorded after his health recovery. But the early ones, I just can't imagine he was ever satisfied with anything.
I know, I can't either. And, you know, he was a voracious record collector and very, you know, detailed documentarian of all these things that he collected and wanted, you know, everything just to be just so in his mind with musical history. But I think the Brian Wilson comparison is so interesting because in many ways he obviously wasn't working on the scale that Brian Wilson was working on. But in many ways, the same signs, you know, and the same things are there with him that were there with Brian as he went through the Smile period and tried to, you know, expand and have others kind of understand it.
Can you hear sounds forming in your head? Do they say more than you've ever said? Will you share them? Will you hoard instead? People take so much, they use and discard. If you try to touch, their rules are hard. They may still return your gifts unopened. Others made the same mistake. Men like Wilson, Barrett, Walker, Drake. On the journey they were forced to make, people take so much, then leave. If you lean, you have no safe crutch except your own conviction. It drives away your lovers and keeps at bay the others. They flee the starving artist or bleed to feed his heart. Hunger, 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 hunger. In New Zealand,
one thing I wanted you to maybe touch on a little bit is talk about, I don't know if it's resentment, jealousy, or what it is when bands left the Flying Nun scene or left New Zealand to go somewhere else. They suddenly were, I don't know if they were cast out, but there was something about it that turned some people the wrong way, right?
Yeah, and I think it was kind of, well, it's a lot of factors. It's sort of, in, you know, as much as I understand about the character of New Zealand, I mean, there is a lot of this very self-deprecating place. We're the underdogs, we're the little guys. And it's also common in British culture too. It's like if you go above your station, it kind of angers,
yes,
a lot of folks. And it also kind of reminds me of the whole, like, you know, what's the biblical thing where Jesus goes, can't go back to his hometown, because it's just, you
right.
know, there's he's not, his preaching isn't going to work in his hometown. I think there was
right.
definitely a piece of that with Martin. I think also the fact that he had essentially kind of gone through so many, when you think about how many of his ex-band members were in other Flying Nun bands at various times,
I know,
he kind of spread around some issues there. But I do think, you know, Roger Shepherd says, you know, that he was certainly interested in wanting the Chills to break big. And I think it was I'm speculating, but I'm sure there was a bit of kind of ambivalence in the Flying Nun scene. I'm sure people wanted him to succeed and also not to succeed too much and get above his
right.
station. you know, I think a lot of that just has healed, you know, in the last 20 years. And I think Martin, and I think you see with the tributes that have come, there's a page
yes.
on, there's a great New Zealand music site that I talk about all the time called Audio Culture. Mm-hmm. And Audio Culture basically has been publishing all week long tributes from people like Jane Dodd and, you know, various members that had been in the band with him before, Francisca Griffin, you know, all these folks. And it's just an outpouring, and not just from the Flying Nun scene, but, you know, you're hearing from all kinds of American indie bands that were influenced. And,
yes.
So, yeah, I think there was a bit of resentment in the early days, but I think folks also understood that, you know, there's a little bit of an Icarus in Martin's story. Did he fly too close to the
yeah.
sun? And then he got the big record deal with Slash and did Submarine Bells. Things seemed to be picking up. And then he went to L.A., and he was in the L.A. scene and using L.A. session musicians and using L.A. drugs, you know. And then that's where things just
right.
kind of like – so even if there was some resentment, like, I think there's an understanding, too, that, like, there's a lot of – there's a lot of baggage that comes with having to go big and hit the big time and be in the studio with producers and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it's very complicated. But in the end, I think we, you know, and especially with his kind of late career resurgence, there had been just a sense that I think kind of like a reassessment of his legacy and a great appreciation of it in New Zealand. I mean, you know, it's hard for us to imagine, but I was actually chatting on Suburbs FOD Facebook with Liam McClendo, and he was saying how the Chills were like classic rock in New Zealand in the 90s. And kind of like, yeah, it's just a very different perspective.
Well, to your point, I think that, you know, originally they had scheduled his memorial service at a certain venue, but quickly realized that there was no way it was going to hold all the people that planned to be there and had to actually move it to a larger venue. And I believe are actually going to have it streamed if you want to, you know, sit in and watch, which is amazing too. But I know we've said, and I'm so glad you mentioned some of the American bands, because we mentioned, well, maybe Martin didn't ever make quite the perfect album and, you know, there was all this, but what is there influenced the American indie scene to a massive degree? I mean, there are so many groups you could name who were just in the late 80s when they found this stuff, just going crazy and, you know, trying to find money to get Flying Nun stuff imported because the shipping costs were so expensive. Right. And borrowing stuff.
Yeah, attempting, I think it is a pavement, like going to New Zealand to tour. Like, yes. You know, they didn't have a ton of money, but like they went, you know, they went back to like Kiss the Ring, essentially. They wanted to go to the Flying Nun.
Exactly.
I think they wanted to find the Flying Nun office in Dunedin, and there wasn't one at the time, you know, stuff like that. So yeah, big influence on the American indie scene for sure. And I think even you see it in younger indie bands too. Like,
yes.
And I'm going to see this band actually tonight called Quivers. It's a really great Australian band that I like, and they love the Chills. Or, oh, you know, it's like it's in their materials. We try to sound like the Chills, you know. And there's a whole jangle pop revival going on in San Francisco. The Reds, Pinks, and the Purples, another great current band. Glenn Donaldson like did a big tribute to Martin Phillips after he died.
Saw that.
So the influence lives on, like, both in those like 80s, 90s American, you know, alternative bands, and also today, you know. So,
yes.
Yeah, I think it's been a little bit surprising how big it's. I think the response was bigger than I thought it would be. It's sad that it has to come this way. It's always been difficult to gauge how popular, quote unquote, worldwide the Chills are, Martin Phillips are. And
yeah.
I think what I'm seeing is they're a lot more popular than I ever imagined.
It's amazing, too. And I think, you know, around the time of the advent of the internet, it was that period where he was not, you know, really functioning that much as a musician, right? It was before sort of the rise and everything. And it is, like you said, very difficult to gauge how much, when the internet started getting there, how much the Chills' influence and their music suddenly started spreading around. But I'm certain, you know, it had a degree of it there, because a lot of this, you know, the record guides and the people that were musicians were talking, and there was always that influence of Flying Nun, and certainly the Chills being right at the forefront of that, even though, as Liam said, they were classic rock. I love that. I guess the other thing I had written down in my notes, Nick, was we just saw not long ago, and I once again thank you from the bottom of my heart, the Brave Words reissue came out, and they worked on that stuff. And I wondered, to your mind, you know, will we see more of that, or do you think there's a lot of stuff? You know, I can't imagine who's going to have the job of, you know, being the curator of his library or whatever, you know, recordings and demos and all that stuff has been left behind. But do you think we'll see a lot more of that sort of thing, Chills music either being remastered, remixed, or new stuff that was out there that may come to light?
I think, well, two things. Number one, Martin was working on a project that I guess is pretty much done, where he had gone in and through this kind of archiving of the Flying Nun masters, he went back to a bunch of old demos that never got recorded and got together with his current band and essentially reimagined a bunch of those songs. Supposedly was on the verge of being released. He was talking about it right before he died. So I am absolutely fascinated about what'll come out of that project. I'm sure it'll get released. And also, there's been this big project. I mean, you got to love the New Zealand Library and Archives system, because they have, digitized all the masters that were, some of them were like left in closets and they were, you know, luckily rescued. So I feel like there's got to be a lot more material. There could be live stuff out there that we've never heard.
Yes.
And I think there's certainly a market for it. Like, I don't know who would can control, like, trying to do more archival releases of the Chills. The remix of Brave Words was very significant because he had always disliked that album. I don't recall there being any other remixes planned, but, I mean, who knows? The problem is, like, you can't really remix the Dunedin double, right?
My mind like a loving touch. I'm not asking too much. I just don't want the worry of telling myself. Tell me a story.
Tell me a story.
Let me drift. Tell me a story.
Tell me a story.
Frantic drift. Let me rest in peace or in pieces, let me die. Just tell me I can survive. If you want to keep me alive.
But yeah, there could be some mid-career, late-career stuff that's sitting out there. And as you mentioned, I mean, like, Martin just had piles and piles of lyrics. And I could easily see there being like a Woody Guthrie sort of album, like the Mermaid Avenue thing, where they like go in Martin's notebooks and get some bands to record, like, because he might have stopped, you know, creating musically, but apparently he was filling up pages and pages of lyrics, and he kept he had a diary for day-to-day diary of every year they were performing, and someone's gonna Amazing. Write that book for sure. I mean, he showed some of his diaries in the documentary, and mm-hmm. one page was like tiny, tiny script.
I remember
filled,
that.
filled. So it'll be a big project, but I think there could be some amazing stuff in there for some sort of a biography or something like that. So I would venture there's more Chills stuff to come. One we know for sure, and you know. There's certainly the interest, I think, out there to sort of go into the catalog and see what might come out. Martin will live on for sure. And I think his influence, because he continues to influence younger generations, I think it's going to go on for some time, you know, which is very pleasing.
I totally agree. And I love the idea of current musicians finding, you know, lyrics or whatever it might be and putting those together. I think that's wonderful. Something I learned that kind of blew my mind also about the Chills was I just recently finished reading a book on the history of Creation Records from the UK, founded by the legendary Alan McGee. And the Creation issued a Chills compilation album. They actually put Kaleidoscope World out on Creation Records, which is wild to think about. Personally, I'd take that over any of the Oasis records, but right. if I had to choose a Creation album, but it's kind of, you know, mind-blowing that McGee, who certainly loved, a theatrical spectacle as well, but also deep down really loved pop music, you know, and when he heard that, he was like, this is what we got to put out on our label, you know, and that kind of blew my mind that connection was there, and you know, I think there's a lot of those, and just seeing, you know, as you pointed out, anyone who really is interested should go to the audioculture.co.nz and look at this stuff, because it's crazy how many people he met and came across, and like you said, went to be in other bands, and just the whole tendrils of the chills spread out in a lot of ways that a lot of people probably didn't know about. And like you said, it's terrible that it has to be this way, but we may learn a lot more and find things out that we never knew, you know, because of this. So I guess I'm trying to cheer myself up and look at a silver lining of some kind.
It is rough. It's hard to do. You know, he was definitely trying to get his, like, affairs in order. Yeah, he had recently. I mean, the other thing that Martin has that'll surprise no one is probably the best collection of Flying Nun recordings by a person that's owned. And some of that was his sort of, you know, and this is why I think that when we interviewed him, I like to think that, well, I think he's a nice guy. That's it. But I also think he recognized, you know, from Patrick, when you gave him like your zine, and that, you know, these are fellow music obsessives, and that his fans are kind of music nerds, and he's one too, and his collection is prodigious. He would say things like, well, I've got every version of this album ever made, and so he was actually selling a lot of his collection, and I was kind of like, you know what? I'm not that I'm glad he died, absolutely not, but like, I'd rather see that collection kind of go somewhere like in archives or somewhere, because he's got all the stuff. But who knows? I don't know what'll happen with that. But yeah, I mean, I think an exhibit out of just his personal stuff. There was an exhibit done a few years ago, but like, it would be unbelievable. He had a lot of stuff. He was collecting a lot of stuff. He was trying to sort of clean up. And so it's kind of another sad aspect was how much he's kind of leaving behind. But hopefully we see new ways of us like learning and accessing the Chills and Martin Phillips going forward. Cause I think that'll happen for sure.
Absolutely. And maybe if that exhibit takes place, that could be finally our impetus to get to New Zealand. We can say we got to go over there to see, you know, the opening night or whatever.
That'd be fantastic. I'm sure there's going to be some big tribute concert and probably an album of some sort. Like, we're going to see. I mean, you know, they did an album like that for Chris Knox, you know, when he sort of, you know, went through that. So I think we'll see some really cool stuff. And because I've been amazed. I hadn't really been on Twitter for a lot of political reasons, and I kind of went back after Martin died because I wanted to hear from all my friends over the world I needed some folks to kind of commiserate with. And those people really aren't on Threads, you know, whatever, who knows why. But I mean, man, and it's still going on. Like, I'm listening to nothing but the Chills, it's tributes are, I think people had a real personal connection to Martin, to the music. And a lot of that has to do with some of the things you were talking about. Like, you know, you had to, back in the day, if you wanted to be a Chills fan, you had to kind of work for it, you know. His older fans feel it as a really personal loss because of how much, you know, you had to get things sent mail order. You had to get, you know, Kaleidoscope World on Homestead Records, you know, instead of flying, you know,
that's
whatever.
Right.
but the new generation has access to all of it. And I think that's also powerful, too. You know, my knowledge of the Chills when I was a fan earliest, back in the mid to late 80s, I didn't know what album came out when. There was stuff I had no idea about. But the younger generation can kind of just go through the whole catalog. And I think it's evident that some of them have, based on, you know, some of the music I hear coming out. So,
I know. So, Nick, I'll just want to say thank you so much for your time and sharing all these thoughts, and certainly fueled each other's passion for the Chills and for Flying Nun. But what would you advise for somebody, let's say, who's listening to this, who may not have, you know, been listening to our podcast way back when we did Flying Nun Weeks, and may not know too much about the Chills, but all of a sudden here he is, or wanting to introduce someone else they know to say, hey, maybe you're going to like this guy. Where would you advise someone start with the whole world of the Chills?
Yeah, it's a tough question. I would have said Kaleidoscope World, but here's why I wouldn't advise that now. Back in when that album first came out on Homestead for
That's
us
right.
in America, it was, I think, 12 songs, and it was just the singles and EPs. And now if you go stream it, it's been bloated to like 30 songs. And there's a lot of stuff that an extreme Chills nerd would love, but it's B-sides kind of stuff. So you might get a little confused by that version. If you can get the original version of Kaleidoscope World, start there. If not, I don't know, go for Submarine Bells. If that doesn't hit you, then there's no point going anywhere else. But if it does, then you go back to Kaleidoscope World. And Brave Words has been remixed. It sounds a lot better than the original version. It's got fantastic songs. It was their first actual album, because between 1980 and like 87, it was just singles and EPs, which that was flying gun. That's
all we could afford to put out at the time was a single.
right. So, you know, starting with Submarine Bells and Brave Words, those are cohesive albums. And Kaleidoscope World, at least the streaming version, has become a compendium. And there's some cool stuff on there, but some stuff actually I don't even care for too much, because it's just been bloated out to like 35 songs, which is how things go on the streaming services. Like, albums don't exist as they used to anymore. And I would just say if you are someone that loves 60s music in general, you're gonna love the Chills. Like, if you're into the Beatles, the Kinks, you're gonna vibe with the Chills. I mean, they are but again, it's pop music. He knew how to craft a song. There's, you know, you're not going to get a 12-minute Sister Ray kind of thing out of Martin Phillips. You know, maybe that would be cool. he definitely knows how to make a statement in, you know, 325 or 250. And, you know, maybe if you just wanted to start with a song, maybe start with Pink Frost. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's one that is just a standout track from the early days. But yeah, I mean, you really, if you're interested, if you like pop music, you like power punk, you like, you know, stuff that actually is well crafted, like, you can't go wrong with really any of the Chill stuff.
That's very true.
You'll know quickly. Yeah. Give it a shot. You'll know if you like it. You know, they're not a hard edge at all. They're not metal. They're not punk, really. I mean, there's one of those bands that have a punk sensibility, but zero punk sound, you know.
Right.
But yeah, those would be my... So basically, I'm saying everything. I'll amend my statement. Just go get anything, you'll be fine.
I love that. I think that's great advice. And like you said, there's stuff on that expanded Kaleidoscope World that never would have been put on vinyl. Nobody would have spent the money to do that. But when it doesn't cost...
I couldn't afford
upload one track, no more cost on the streamings, yes. But yeah, I totally concur with that. And Pink Frost, amazing. Night of Chill Blue is a song they used to open their sets with, so that's another one you might try. It's got that beauty and haunting spirit to it that's just amazing. But there's so much of that. So, like you said, I think you can't really go wrong. And if somebody is about to embark on that journey, I'm jealous, and I wish you all the best listening, because it's going to be cool. And I know that Scott Parks has vowed to undertake something similar to what you did, to go through the needles and plastic and listen to all the records as he went through. So,
yeah,
best of luck and to anybody who is going to do this. Nick, thank you so much. Any final thoughts here before we wrap up?
Yeah, I mean, just thanks for having me on. It was great to talk to you. It's crushingly sad, and I've been pretty emotional about it, but having this talk kind of actually making me get excited just thinking about what he left. What the music is always going to be there. Yeah. Martin's always going to be there. We had a chance to meet him and talk to him, and that's a cherished memory that will, you know, he was just so kind, so generous. He seemed to be enjoying it. I was like, why is he enjoying what these goofy ass old guys are asking?
His people were trying to get him to go to dinner, and he was like, just wait a minute, right. 5 minutes. Yeah. It was great.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah, but thanks. It was great to.
Oh
to,
yeah.
To,
I've been looking forward to this very much, and it's cathartic to speak with you. And And it helps when you know other people are feeling the same sadness and that weight. So we will do our best to get that off of ourselves as much as we can and continue to cherish Martin's music. And, of course, we'll say rest in power. And Nick, you suggested Submarine Bells, I think, to close out. And I think that's a wonderful suggestion. So I am Patrick Foster. With me has been
Nick Scalera.
Thank you, Nick, so much. Rest in power, Martin. And here is Submarine Bells on Rock in the Suburbs.
His sort of genius was the ability to pull in like all these 60s influences and whatever was sort of in the water in Dunedin and just create this new synthesis.